It's like you're Charlie in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and you inherited the Chocolate Factory.
I built the Chocolate
you
Factory.
You built the Chocolate Factory. So what does that do to your ability to enjoy the chocolate?
Oh, love it.
Our guest later is Master of the Hooniverse, Russell T. Davis. Well, you've been through a lot.
So I took our son, just the two of us, to the zoo this week. And there's a little area in the London Zoo where monkeys roam free. And these monkeys, because maybe as I say this, you're picturing like a big monkey.
Not a chimpanzee.
Right.
Not Bubbles.
Right. This isn't Bubbles the chimp.
Like a monkey you would see in a fez.
Yes, yes. So we're going through and I'm free. I'm moving in a free way. However, at one point, Gene and I were somewhat close, just the two of us, to this one monkey. I happened to notice the teeth were a little more razor sharp than I would have guessed for an animal that they just allow to interact with humans. But the zookeepers know best.
Was it baring its teeth at you? Did it seem nasty?
I just thought those look like, you know, they look like they could really come at you.
Mm.
So we're walking. It's nice. It's a lovely spring day. Suddenly, another adult says to me, one of them is on your back. I don't know what happened, but I had a blackout. I had a blackout. I believe there was a lot of jerking and I was screaming. And then the person, I think the same person, but maybe not, said, it is off your back now.
I'm so, sure it was after that little episode.
And so then I was like trying to locate my child. And I looked down and he was literally doubled over. Like he was sort of in a crouched position because he was laughing so hard that he couldn't stand upright. A crowd had, of course, gathered and other adults were laughing at me. How did a monkey get onto my person without me knowing a monkey had got on my person? Like, I cannot sleep through anything. I am a very, 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 very little sensitive princess in the pea.
It is, I think, already the biggest regret of my life that I didn't come to the zoo on Saturday. Because I've seen how you react to, for example, a slug.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like something from the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
And do you think you trying to get a monkey off your person was like how somebody might convulse during an exorcism?
Yes, it was certainly that raw and uncontrolled. And I felt so sad that you hadn't been there to bear witness because I thought he would have loved it.
Well, maybe in my lifetime, time travel will be invented. And I will be going to the Regent's Park Zoo in London, 23rd of March, 2024, monkey enclosure. Now, speaking of time travel, do you see?
Jeff, that's so great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't you love that to British television producers in the 1960s and the BBC Radiophonic Workshop? That is what a time-travelling spaceship sounds like.
Yes.
And don't you love that they've now kept that for 60 years?
Tradition!
Our guest today, I want to call him the writer's writer. And the reason I want to call him that is so many of the showrunners and creators that we have interviewed on this podcast, when we've said, who is the person who you're just in awe of? It's the name that's come up time and time and time again. Russell T. Davis. He's been a permanent fixture of British television for decades. Queer as Folk, It's a Sin, Very English Scandal, Nolly, a recent one, talked about on this podcast, and that's really stayed with me. And of course, Doctor Who. He single-handedly, out of a love of this show,
oh my God,
reinvented it and is now one of the most valuable properties of the BBC and probably seen as key to its survival. And he is a man who breathes TV. And not only that, but most of what he's done has been here in the UK, and he loves the British television landscape. Now, there's also a story with some tragedy to it about why almost all of his work has been in the UK. But he really loves British television.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a big, tall, warm man.
You want him to be your weighted blanket.
I do. That's exactly what I want.
I get that.
Well, the man that I want to be my big weighted blanket is our guest, and he is magnificent. Later on this episode, it's Russell T. Davis.
For my quick watch this week, I watched The Push, Murder on a Cliff, and it was one of the best things I've watched recently.
So what is this? Is it a drama? Is it a documentary?
It's a documentary. And it's about a couple who's on Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh, and she falls from Arthur's Seat.
Which is a big mountain which overlooks the city.
Doesn't everyone know Arthur's Seat?
I think you're being Edinburgh-centric.
Oh, am I?
Yeah, now? Eddie-centric.
Gross, Eddie-sen. And the question is, did her husband push her or did she accidentally slip?
So what form does this take? Are we in the courtroom? Are we in reenactments?
No reenactments, thank God, which is part of why it's great.
Oh, I hate a reenactment.
They're so uncomfortable to watch. So we're mostly in the courtroom because, for reasons I don't understand, Scottish courts allow the trials to be filmed.
And does the Scottish justice system look different? Do they wear the little wigs?
Little wigs abound. What was different, knowing nothing about any legal system, but only having watched The Jury and now The Push and feeling like I'm now an expert, there is a man in a tuxedo.
A tuxedo like a snooker player or a bouncer.
I hate saying the word snooker. I can't say it. I'm not going to
say
it.
Go on. What is it?
Snooker? Why is a snooker player in a tuxedo?
I don't know. But darts players, very much not in tuxedos.
No, but I also don't think a snooker player, see, snooker, I hate it. I also think they don't need to be in tuxedos.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so this guy isn't truly in a tuxedo, but it presents as a bit of one. And he comes in and he goes, "Court!" And then they all stand.
So apart from the tuxedo guy, did you like the judge? Did you like the lawyers?
Loved the judge. Prosecution attorney was such a wonderful little nerd. One issue is he wore this backpack.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel that a backpack says grown up.
Did it look like his mum had sent him off to work for the day with his packed lunch in his backpack?
That's exactly what it looked like. But then he really proves his abilities. He seems like a very warm man, which I was surprised by because I think a lot of lawyers can love themselves too much.
So this is bleak. Sarah was in a bike accident and you were riding the wrong way down a one-way street.
Yeah. One of my great moves.
However, one of these ambulance chaser lawyers convinced you that a big payout was coming. And for the first couple of years we knew each other, there was a lot of interaction with... How would you stereotype him?
I'm just going to do an impression. How you doing? It was like a real, like, a New York lawyer. I don't want to ever be making fun of anybody's appearance, although I will do it. So picture Martin Scorsese minus all that money. And he was going to try to help me get my money, even though I was the one going the wrong way down the one-way street.
And that's why, for the first couple of years of our relationship, there was some sense of, oh, we don't ever need to worry about retirement plans. Because this big payout's coming.
You're overstating this slightly, but we'd hoped for something that never came. And in case, I don't want people thinking, because I think you're presenting me now like I'm...
American.
Yes. And I don't appreciate that.
Given that it's harrowing subject matter and it is a documentary, it's real people, is it hard to watch?
Beats of it are hard to watch because the grieving mother is such a central figure. Some of this is compensated for by the gorgeous landscape of Edinburgh.
What a city.
And I really just enjoyed getting to see that city free of my own trauma. Because whenever I'm in Edinburgh, it's usually for the festival.
So you're likening the trauma of having an Edinburgh with largely positive reviews and satisfied...
Entirely positive, but not enough of them.
And satisfied
no
audiences.
No broadsheets. Entirely positive, but no broadsheet reviews. All I'm saying... is that Edinburgh, for me, carries a little bit of trauma. A different kind, I admit.
So you're saying it's less traumatic to see Edinburgh as a backdrop to The Push than it is to see Edinburgh where you're passing posters for your enemies with 5 stars plastered over them?
Yes, that is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, I think that's only a reason for a very small subsection of our listeners to watch it. But there's plenty there for everybody else too.
This is the next thing you guys should be watching. It is incredibly compelling television.
This week, I watched Derek Delguardio's In and of Itself, which you may remember was recommended by Martin Schofield in the email. And I think in his email, he didn't quite know what to make of it. Now, when I hold my hands up and say, here's why I'm ultimately the wrong person to evaluate this show, because I just don't like magic.
No.
I like an individual trick. Like, I like to see a lady sawn in half, not because I'm a misogynist,
uh-huh.
Or you know, I like seeing a ping pong ball disappear from underneath a cup.
I thought you were going in a different direction with the ping pong after the sexist thing you said about liking to watch ladies being carved.
But here's what I don't like is the whole artifice of it and the build-up. Ultimately, every magic trick is one thing. Something has happened that can be very easily explained.
Uh-huh.
And they distract you into making you think it can't be explained. And this process used to be fast, and now it is incredibly drawn out and theatrical.
Uh-huh.
But the distraction that he employs is that he is a storyteller.
Oh.
He's a wise and weary traveller who wants to tell you about his journey in life, the lessons he's learned, the strangers he's met, and he's going to throw in a few fables. But because of this drawn-out way in which it's performed, it means you see a trick about once every 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And they're great tricks.
Are they?
But I'm so exhausted by all the preamble. I just want the amble.
Yeah,
or the post-amble. I imagine he's revered as a magician. But let me describe his look and his personality style. So he is like someone's best man who you only meet for the first time at the wedding because he is the hometown best friend who never comes to visit the city.
Uh-huh.
And he's wearing a three-piece suit, which doesn't help with the best man vibe.
Oh.
And here's the thing, from the film, it seems like the atmosphere in the theatre is incredible. And at one stage, mass hysteria breaks out. Now, this is why I thought you might like it.
Uh-huh.
Because it's lots of people sobbing together in a room.
Oh.
Yeah, plot twist.
Oh.
Okay, I'll blow one thing.
Okay.
So on the way in, before the show, there's a hallway. And on the wall are lots of different cards. And audience members are encouraged to pick one of these. And each card says something different. So it could be, I am a mother. I am a free spirit. I am an artist.
Uh-huh.
One of them was, I am an iconoclast.
Uh-huh.
If you're picking that card for yourself, you're a problem.
Yeah, but you're a problem if it says I am an artist.
Well, most of these things, actually. And that forms the basis of a set piece involving what people have chosen.
Does he eventually tell people that they're more than just one thing? And they're all sobbing together because they all realize they're bigger than this way they see
themselves. Yes, okay. Yeah. But because it was a real thing off Broadway, there are a lot of famous people in the audience.
Uh-huh.
One of whom,
oh my God,
is Bill Gates.
Uh-huh. R.I.P. Oh, was he still alive?
He looked alive. I mean, I saw him blink. Anyway, this is a spoiler, but I want to tell you the card that Bill Gates chose for himself.
Okay.
I am a leader. Now, Bill Gates is a leader, but it's this thing that is a thing that other people should say about you. And I don't care about all the philanthropic work he's doing. I don't care that he's eradicating malaria. But choosing I am leader, I'm sorry.
You're done with him now?
Yeah.
He may or may not have done with Jeffrey Epstein, that's less of a thing than the fact that he said he was a leader.
Yeah, I'm uninstalling Windows 95. But I just found it cringy. There was an earnestness to it that doesn't sit well.
Do you think you're missing something because you weren't in the room?
I think what was happening in the room felt almost like one of those evangelist revival events where people start fainting.
I wonder if I'd be susceptible to that. What I think could work on me is if it was like a fainting disease was going around. If it was like there might be, if you feel itchy, it could mean that you suddenly faint. I think my body could get itchy and then cause a lack of consciousness. But you see how it's a physical thing, not emotionally.
With teenage girls in high schools from time to time.
Yeah.
Sorry to gender stereotype it, but I think there have been documentaries.
You have really hated women in this episode.
Well, we'd love to hear from you if you've either watched The Push, Murder on a Cliff, or Derek Delguardio's In and of Itself. What did you think? Also, what about this for a topic? Edinburgh. So we like watching things set in Edinburgh to help Sarah distance herself from the trauma of being a performer at the Fringe. So Trainspotting, that Proclaimers musical.
Oh, da-da-da-da.
Here's a dark story.
Hey.
You had a miscarriage some years ago. Uh-huh. And it was a bleak time in our lives.
I'm laughing because I had no idea that that's what you were going to say.
And I came home from work one evening, and as I came through the front door, I could just hear you sobbing hysterically. It was in this period. And I thought, she's having a hard time of it. And then I came into the living room and you were watching the Proclaimers musical and it was just very moving.
That's so funny. I forgot that happened.
So any Edinburgh recommendations? Also courtroom recommendations. I loved LA Law when I was a teenager. And I'll tell you what I liked 15 years ago. I can't imagine it's aged very well and it's very network TV-ish. But Boston Legal with William Shatner yes. and James Spader. But it is a bit cheesy and has a lot of saxophone music for the transitions between scenes.
Never a great sign.
No. So any legal recommendations? I don't mean as opposed to illegal.
You're not asking, or you're not asking for the names of lawyers to represent someone.
No, and I'm not saying anything except like snuff movies.
Right.
You know what I mean? Also examples of magic done well.
No, I think for me, there is no magic done well.
So all that and your recommendations as well. The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
Are you ready to start begging people for money?
I was born ready.
Sarah told me yesterday that somebody she went to school with is married to a billionaire. And my first response was, could you send her a begging DM?
With this in mind, join our Patreon. Now, I'm not talking to the oldies right now. I'm talking to our newies. We are going to presumptuously, positively, arrogantly assume that having the big Russell T. Man on this week's episode could perhaps get some new listeners on board.
If you're wondering why you haven't heard from him yet, we always have the interview at the end of the podcast. We know it is a decision we're making.
I know. You're so angry. Are you so angry? What are you? You get Russell T. Davies and then you don't put him on until 25 minutes. If that's your attitude, you're probably not the right person for this podcast. But if you're thinking, this is interesting, who are these two zany, sweet, likable, middle-aged dreamers? Nice to meet you. Thanks for joining. You might want to join not just the listening experience of the podcast, but the Patreon overall. Why? Because we provide bonus content every week, which is an extended interview with whatever celebrity writer we have spoken to that week. We have spoken to the likes of Jesse David Armstrong, Charlie Brooker, Jack Thorne, Daisy Mae Cooper, Greg Davies, and Alex Horn. The list goes on. And you get to listen not to our quick little 18 minutes that we put together for you, but to these long, flowing, tangential, interesting convos. So if part of the reason you have wound up here today is that you like TV and you like hearing from the people who make it, perhaps you'd like to join our Patreon. Perhaps we just strike you as lovely and you want to support us, because really, I'm not going to message this girl that I know from elementary school who's married to a billionaire. After you mentioned her last night, I fell into a deep hole on her Instagram page. They have many properties and I would like, just putting it out there, Rebecca, I'm talking to you. We were good friends in 1987 and I'd like to put a price tag on that $80,000. Can I have some? I think I was sweet to you on a couple of occasions. How many people want money from her, I wonder? Probably not that many. I think I'm one of the only people who thinks this way.
To find out more about our Patreon and to join it, to sign up, is patreon.com/theyliketowatch. And coming up, British TV screenwriting royalty. He may be the king. He's probably the king.
You think he's the king?
He's the reigning monarch, I would say.
Oh.
Russell T. Davies. This week, in our never-ending quest to find something to watch, we alighted on Palm Royale on Apple TV+. And I think we chose it primarily because it's got Kristen Wiig in it.
One of the great comic actresses of her generation.
Could you put a number on the amount of times you've watched Bridesmaids?
Probably start to finish, 18.
But I would say that you watch it like other people watch the news. It's a thing that you have on in the background sometimes.
Oh, yes. And I think it was somehow factored into me being in labor. I was in labor for close to 80 hours. And when we were still at our house, I was like, oh, that'll be a fun thing. And then it turns out that even like a comfort blanket of a comedy doesn't help you when you're in agonizing physical pain.
So set in the most exclusive club in Florida in 1969, and it looks beautiful.
And it looks not just beautiful, but beautiful in the way that you want to eat it. So if something's on the Amalfi Coast, I can be like, that's so gorgeous, but I'm not feeling the need to, I want to bite into it. But anything sort of pastel and Floridian, you want to like,
What would it taste like if you were to bite into it?
I'll tell you exactly what it'll taste like. There's a gelateria near our house, and they do a flavor that is yogurt and passion fruit gelato. And that is what I think Palm Royale tastes like.
So this club is populated by ladies who are they glamour pusses? Do you think they're glamour pusses?
Yes.
And they sunbathe and they sip cocktails and they gossip and boast about their philanthropy. And Kristen Wiig's character, she wants in. and she wants in by posing as one of them. Is she one of them? And why does she want in? It might not be as simple as it initially appears. So that is the show.
Mm-hmm.
The show I've seen it the most compared to is White Lotus.
What?
Yeah, I know. And it's just not that show. Maybe it's because it's an environment you want to spend time in or bite. But with White Lotus, it's not just being there. It's the characters and the stories. And three episodes in, I think that stuff is quite lacking in this show. And it's more just something you'd watch to pass the time.
If you're looking for a show and you don't need it to be a 10 out of 10, but you're just looking for something good, both The Gentleman and Shogun were much better TV shows than this one looks like it's going to be.
I think maybe it scrapes a 6, but it's more likely a 5 point something.
There was something in the pilot episode where I was like, what is happening? So as we all know, part of the iconic opening of Bridesmaids involves Kristen Wiig climbing over John Hamm's motorized gate to his property and getting stuck as it starts to move. Great physical comedy. There's a scene in this where they're making Kristen Wiig climb over a wall to get into this resort. And it's like, what are you doing?
If you were Kristen Wiig, wouldn't you say, guys, just want to flag something. I don't know if I did this film Bridesmaids and there was a scene that was somewhat similar to this, but
a million times better and over a decade ago.
As well as wanting to bite the show, do you want to go and lie on one of those sun lounges around the pool? It is a nice looking club.
Yes, I do want to.
Let me give you the binary. Poolside or beach?
If there's cocktail service and texture in the vista, I'm definitely beach.
I'm definitely poolside.
I know, we should get a divorce.
It's the sand.
There's something about just being able to get your body into an actual body of water that I think takes you to a different place than a pool can ever take you.
I think this is just about you thinking of the sea as your toilet.
I do think of the sea as my toilet.
If you were on a sun lounger that was equidistant,
uh-huh,
in one direction the sea,
uh-huh,
and the other direction a toilet,
uh-huh,
you would always go in the sea and pee.
I think so, but that's because it's so, when you're in a bathing suit as a woman, have you ever been in a one piece as a woman and urinated? It's like a whole deal. And so to just urinate in the sea is so much easier. And I don't mind other people's urine. I'm kind of into it. I'm not into it. Sorry. Don't anyone get any ideas. But I really don't mind pee. And I'm unconvinced that I'm killing sea life.
Didn't we find out that is some kind of a problem? The hormones and the enzymes in the piss are bad for the sea life.
My hormones are like, like, they're so great, my hormone levels. They are. I have very natural, I'm not on any birth control because of your sperm. I don't need any. So it's, I don't know what women are having hormone stuffs, but it, don't look at me. I don't really eat any processed meat. I guess I do eat a lot of eggs. Do you think I'm getting hormones from the eggs?
Yeah. And then.
And then pissing them into these sweet little fish that just want to have a nice time. Well, I'm sorry, but it's very annoying to take off a one piece as a woman.
So I'll take poolside over beach. I'm not sure about a club, though, because this is a very exclusive club.
We are both actively anti-members clubs, and we judge people who join those clubs. But then, so we have a friend, and he pointed out to me about myself that what I like to do is run my mouth about how problematic and disgusting members clubs are. But every time I invite you, you come. And it's like, well, it's because I like going.
I just don't like anything I've seen about the environment of these places. I don't want to eat a club sandwich. I've got a tiny mouth. And I want a sandwich that is wieldy enough that I can just get it in without disassembling it.
I think that you'd get that experience at a club because it'd be very much like, Mr. Lloyd, we know about your, we know, they wouldn't say we know about your small mouth, but they would say, we know about how you like it. And then your sandwich would come to you diced up tiny, like for a baby, so that you could put it in your little tiny mouth that doesn't open so wide.
So as evidence by the biting impulse, this show is very, it's very stylized, isn't it? But part of that is nobody looks even remotely the age they are in real life.
They all look like they have a filter on them.
Ricky Martin plays a waiter.
This really, I'm a big fan of Ricky Martin, and I was very excited to see him in it, and I think he's good. I think his acting is strong, but the show is too shitty.
The radio station I used to work for also made the talk show TFI Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to go and hang out there on my day off and avail myself of the free drink because I was in my 20s. And Ricky Martin came on as a guest one week, and he travels with his own special light with an orange gel on it. So whenever he appears on a talk show, they set up this special light for him and have him lit in orange from one side.
I love it.
Another reason it looks so great is because it's a period piece and it's the late 60s. I am not sure that accuracy in some aspects of this show has been the focus. So, for example, there isn't a fug of cigarette smoke everywhere.
Right. Messing up the gorgeous colours that they've got going on.
Don't get me wrong, I can get a bit sick of the fetishization of people watching things like Mad Men and going, oh, wouldn't it just be great to be breathing in smoke all the time? But it is strange to have something set in the 60s and for them to have made the decision, oh, there's none of that. Also, some of the language.
So at one point, one character refers to something as triggering.
Yes, that was never used as a verb until, I think, the 2000s and maybe even in 2010s.
Then the other one was at one point a character refers to people of color. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that in the 60s that wasn't a phrase because there were some other phrases.
Exactly. But then again, it does beg the question, well, what are you expecting them to say then if they're not saying that? And that opens up a whole other can of worms. There's also at times they are a changing plot
in that
there are some hippie feminists on the periphery getting into the heads of these ladies. Laura Dern plays one of these hippies. There is a good cast in this show, but the cast is better than the show. Alison Janney is in it.
Yep.
Carol Burnett is in it. And she's in some flashback stuff, but she's largely in a coma. And I just want to say that even in a coma, that woman is funny.
Yeah.
There is even stuff she can do with the slightest movement of an eyebrow that is funnier than most things I see on television.
Her coma face is pretty strong.
Yeah. Here's, I think, the dilemma we have. Mm. On this podcast, the idea is we will tell you if something's good enough to watch.
Uh-huh.
Because we've got excellent taste. Mm-hmm. So we'll only recommend excellent things. And this isn't that. This is real passing the time stuff. But it's kind of a nice world to be in. I think there are many, many better things for you to be watching. But if you want to look at something that you want to bite.
If you've got like a real hard on for that place and time and Kristen Wiig and Carol Burnett and Alison Janney, you'll get through it.
Have you watched Palm Royale? What did you think? Is there something like this, but better, that we could be watching that isn't The White Lotus?
Oh, nice.
Also, are you somebody who wants to travel like us, but you can't at the moment? And are there shows which just feel like going on holiday?
Also nice.
What about biggest disparity between number of stars and quality of show? Poolside or beach?
Beach.
And even if you don't consider yourself a pedant, which I don't, are there things which drive you mad if the attention to detail and the authenticity isn't spot on? The email address is
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
And coming up next, this was such an exciting guest for us to have. Can I just tell you that this has been healing for me?
Tell me more.
Because when I was a kid, I really loved Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
So much.
Mm-hmm.
And one day during the school holidays, as a family, we went to Chester Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that I was going to go dressed as Tom Baker's fourth Doctor.
Okay.
Floppy hat.
Okay.
Long coat. Tom Baker scarf. In those days, you couldn't buy the sonic screwdrivers. They weren't as merchandise savvy as they are now. But I had, as the character of the Doctor had at the time, a bag of jelly babies, which then, once we arrived at the zoo, I was feeling like in my bones I was the Doctor and other people were looking at me and thinking, oh, there's that Time Lord. That's how great I felt about my own costume.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go up to little kids and say, jelly baby?
Oh, God.
And they'd take the jelly baby. And it was a nice thing. Until I heard a slightly older kid go, look at him. He thinks he looks like Doctor Who, but he doesn't. He just looks like a kid.
Oh.
And I feel that the trauma of that moment informs a lot of my personality to this day.
I completely agree.
So I guess this week is a very positive Doctor Who experience to add on to the bad one.
You don't just look like a kid. You look like an old man.
Coming up next, we're going to talk about writing, his career, lots of stuff, as well as Doctor Who. It is the genial genius, Russell T. Davies. Are people constantly asking you to read and look at stuff here?
All the time. It's almost every day. I would say I probably get about 360 requests a year for that. And most of those are friends. That's the hard thing. It's a friend or someone you know really well. Or, hello, my cousin's dying. Can you read her script?
Oh, God.
And it's like, it takes as long to reply to someone saying no nicely as it does to read it half the time. You know, because it's like, I don't like to just say, no, I'm too busy.
Do you need a cut and paste response?
I do. That's what I mean to do. I keep, and then somehow that's so cynical, I can't quite get myself to do it. Let me also say, a lot of the time I do read them. And
this is what I want to know. What happens that makes you go, all right, this is going to be one of the X number that I do look at?
Either, if it's personal and you know them well, sometimes you really know them well, and it's awful to say no. So normally when I'm backed into a corner, part of the problem with reading other people's scripts is that very often, the great majority of cases, it's no, this doesn't work. And also beyond that, you're not a writer. And I can't say that to someone. I can't. That's crushing someone's dreams.
So I don't
someone
think...
should be allowed to paint or do whatever they want as long as that makes them happy.
I think that's right, but I also think that there's like freedom in understanding it's this is not meant to be your job.
Oh, gosh.
I think it's gorgeous. It's like whatever you're doing over here that somehow doesn't feel as special to you, but you're still serving society. You made the right choice.
Well, exactly. They might be great parents or
lovers.
I'm none of those things. It's
like, right. I think that like the singularity of focus that someone like you has to have comes at a cost. And that's great.
Knowing we're going to do this today, I read a lot of A Writer's Tale, which is a series of emails that you wrote in the mid-noughties.
A mighty toe. Do you know, I can barely look at it. It's like opening a furnace. But I genuinely want to write something that's about writing, like to write.
I was so struck by the extent to which you beat yourself up.
Yeah.
Over going past the deadline or maybe getting the sense that you're squandering a day and then eventually being able to knock a few words out in the evening or whatever.
Yeah.
And what's your relationship with that like these days? Is it better?
Oh, I mean, that book was written at my absolute worst. I talk about being late. I kind of deliver on time and on schedule and on budget. I'm very strict about that, actually. Yeah.
But what about being racked with self-doubt or beating yourself up
that's
about...
That's still there,
that's normal. So you're not someone who gets up and writes?
No. Unless it's due in 2 days' time. Then I can, actually. I can get up and before I've even brushed my teeth, I can write about 4 pages sometimes. It's kind of got ready overnight. You go tick, 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 tick. Once it's ready, it's very fast.
In these emails, you're beating yourself up about that process of needing the 6th month or going to the cafe or pottering about or letting it stew.
I suppose that's still there. That's still the same. I think it's part of the process. I kind of, weirdly now, in the past couple of years, I've slightly begun to trust it. My lovely husband, bless him, you always used to say, I used to come downstairs and go, oh, this is rubbish. This is the script that will fall apart and everyone will discover I'm a fool and I'll never work again. And he used to sit there going, you always say that. You always get there at the end. He's passed away now, bless him. So I miss that person saying your spirit. So I've actually kind of learned to say it to myself. And I've kind of begun to believe. And I've said that out loud and I'm touching wood in your studio because it's
you
like...
You still think you could lose it.
It's like the day will come. Exactly.
If I said to you, do you like actors?
Oh, that's interesting. It's the thing about writing that's never talked about. And actually, it's never talked about between writers and actors.
Uh-huh.
And it's the strangest relationship where you're intensely involved with them and yet completely separate from them. They come after the work. You'd be surprised how little we ever talk about. You'd think probably that over the years, I'd sat in a pub with David Tennant a million times, talking about the character of the Doctor. Almost never. We've sat in a pub and had a nice time. We've never. It would ruin the atmosphere. I said, so, what do you think the Doctor's like? It's just all instinct. I just kind of let it fly. Sometimes, very rarely, an actor will say, can you unpack this for me? Someone said to me once, and I love that phrase, can you unpack this? And you'll have to, of course, you'll be there to have a talk.
Is that a fun question to you, or does it get under your skin?
I quite like it. Everyone likes talking about their script. Yeah. I kind of feel like I haven't got the answer. Actually, there's a lot of writers who do that homework of like where the person went to school. What do they have coffee? Do they have tea? Do they have sugar? What do they vote? And stuff like that. And I don't do that at all. If I have a gift, to be absolutely honest, it's for character. I just start writing them when they have a voice. I can I can see it appear on the page. I can see character with rhythms and speech and history appear in front of me. That's what I do. I think that's why I love writing Doctor Who. It's why I go back to Doctor Who, because he's the hardest thing to write.
Now that you are back on Doctor Who, does this mean everything else stops?
Yes, it does for them. Not in my mind, not in my thinking. There's plenty of things bubbling away there, but it's so busy.
There's a story we've heard about you coming back and it's locked down and you have this fondness on Twitter, and then that's one side of it. But there's also the BBC. They're struggling to fund themselves and they have to think about funding in different ways. And they've got this asset that they feel, for 1,000 different reasons, isn't doing for them what they want it to do. What is the thing that you're able to come in and say, here's what I want to do?
It's what I've been saying anyway. I think we now live in a science fiction age. We live in a world of streaming, and we live in a world where every 11-year-old is watching Stranger Things because there's 11-year-old kids in it, and that's their language, that's their culture, that's their references, that's their memes. And I think it's a real shame for Doctor Who not to be there, not to be up there with the big hitters. And I'm sitting there watching The Mandalorian. I love the things, the Marvel shows, Stranger Things. I think, well, if I'm watching that, that should also be Doctor Who. So even before they approached me, I had already said in various interviews, I think Doctor Who would have to become a co-production. There's no way the BBC is going to fund that. You've also got to look in the long term at the end of the BBC, which is somehow, surely, undoubtedly on its way in some shape or form. What was Doctor Who going to die then? No, you've got to literally prepare for that kind of stuff. But all of that is kind of like the flim-flam on top of the fact that I love it. And it's the only chance you have in television, for me, to really write in pictures, to do pictures. It's all pictures. It's skies. It's explosions. It's armies. It's people on their own on a vast landscape. I love that. It's rope ladders in the sky on Christmas Day. I love that.
The Disney partnership is really what that gives you, an ability to paint different kinds of pictures or more expansive pictures.
Yes, and pictures that match other people's pictures now. I think that's the important thing. If something collapsed, if Disney collapsed tomorrow and we had to go back to making Doctor Who on a normal BBC budget, you know what? We'd all rally around and we'd make it, and suddenly stories would become claustrophobic ghost stories. And a lot of people would like that very much. So I'm not saying you have to have this happen. While it's happening elsewhere, I think it's unfair that it doesn't happen to Doctor Who. And it does open up stories that are now sometimes on a vast scale.
How did you know that you knew how to do that?
That's interesting. Yes, because I always had written like that. I was always breaking the budget on shows and having then to cut back. But even when I was writing ordinary soap operas, I knew I was kind of pushing it. You can see me on the very first thing I wrote outside a television studio is Queer as Folk. I mean, that's visual. It's like you can literally see my arms reaching out thinking I'm no longer in a box. It's why so many Doctor Who stories of mine go up and down, because all of life is kind of on the horizontal, really. We walk through doors and we drive in a straight line, and then the most exciting thing we do is go upstairs and go to bed and make ourselves horizontal again. And actually, I love Doctor Who stories that go up and down. They're forever dangling off tall buildings or on rope ladders in my stories. I mean, it's a strange thing, isn't it? Why have I got that liking? I think my parents suspended me from rubber when I was a child or something. But I love doing it. I love breaking the picture. I used to draw, so there's a frustrated cartoonist inside me. One of my walls in my Manchester house, the entire wall is a frame from an Asterix cartoon. And it's so gorgeous. It's the colours, the movement in it. It's my favourite thing in the world.
Do you have a clean house?
I do, actually. Yes. Do, yeah. Do I look like I have a clean house?
No, No. That's not why I'm asking at all. I just saw the wall.
Well,
and
yes.
I saw this nice piece of art.
The funny thing is, I've got nothing
on.
Else on my walls. Nothing else. I can't find pictures I can live with. I can't. It's like there's nothing on the walls, but one entire wall is a cartoon. And I love that. It's only been up about 6 months, and I love it.
Yeah. Do you think it's inspired you to trust yourself to make some more choices about art on your walls?
No, I think I'll leave it as that.
It's just going to be like that.
That's it, really.
And then I was thinking, does he keep a very pristine house?
It's not pristine.
But it's clean.
It's quite
house.
Right angly.
If you come home with a tote bag, do you empty it or do you just hang it over the back of the door?
Well, I couldn't hang a full bag on a hook. What do you mean? You have like scripts?
I've got tote bags full of stuff everywhere.
Here's what's going on here. It's he's identified habits that he himself has.
Right.
And that's making you feel validated about certain ways that you approach things.
This was a Doctor Who story. You start to become me.
Yes.
I've seen your tote bags on the back of the door. It's annoying me.
So I've got this yellow pad with me today, and I've got a bottle of water. I will go home, I'll put that on the back of the door, and I will forget about it.
Right.
And what I'm actually trying to do is I'm trying to armchair diagnose whether you have ADHD or not.
Right.
Well, I wondered if you'd thought about that.
No, I don't think so. No, not at all. I've actually got, my friend's got ADHD, and I think I wouldn't even tread on that territory.
You describe your approach to writing and then the shame that comes with it, I have found that since I got a diagnosis, I've been able to let go of shame.
I don't apply shame as a huge headline to my career or my writing. That's a side effect of being late with the script. Once the script's delivered, the shame is gone.
Right.
And I think I'm a genius. Honestly, no one loves my own scripts more than I do. I see the faults. I'm not saying it's perfect. For some reason, I watched an episode of It's a Sin the other day. Why did I do it? There was some reason. And I kind of had notes. cut this bit, cut that bit. I always think, I keep learning this lesson. I worked so hard on cutting scripts down and down and down and down and down and down. It was tight and just taut as they can be, which I love. And when I watch them, I go, yes, that's perfect. Watch it a year later, you go, no, you went too far. Just relax a bit. So. Mm.
Do you think, if you notice something like that, then do you think that will
carry on change? To the next
but you'll make the same, you'll same have the same issue on the next
so
script.
So far, I think it's a slow drip. I think if I'm starting to think that means that might.
Down the line, we
and
might
so
have a
So now,
change.
Every time I start a new script, I go, remember that. It hasn't activated itself yet, but it will. I think it will, then maybe it'll be boring.
Can I show you a picture?
What's happening? What's this?
I'll show you a picture. This is me. I'm guessing I'm 7 there with my friend Tristan Maddox.
Oh, no way. There you go. Oh, look at you. To our podcast listener, dear faithful listener, it's a little TARDIS. Are you a proper Doctor Who fan?
Well, this is, what's interesting, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with it, and I had all the magazines.
What year is that?
Well, you tell me. I'm holding some kind of Doctor Who novel. Maybe you can identify it.
Oh, God. Oh, it's The Keeper of Trakan. It's a blur, and I can literally identify it. But that came out... Keeper of Trakan was... Oh, I couldn't... The novels come out long after things were transmitted. So
right.
I couldn't tell you when.
I'm guessing I'm maybe 7 there. Does 1980 sound about right to you?
Yeah. Keeper of Trakan. Yes.
Okay. Plausible.
No, a bit later, I think.
Okay.
Keeper of Trakan. Wait a minute. Yeah, it's a bit tight. A bit later, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So I loved it as a kid. Absolutely adored it. And then I fell off. And it wasn't until you brought it back that I fell back in love with it again. And I've seen every episode. Oh. But our son has recently got into it. He's nearly 8.
Right. Is he? What does he like? What does he like about it?
Well, he has some questions for you. Would you mind?
Come on.
Shall I?
Yeah.
Okay. Against my best instinct, told him we were speaking to you, which I wouldn't have done, but Jeff doesn't keep our Hollywood lifestyle away from our child as much as I would
She's
like
She's worried about
to. I don't want him to become an asshole. Like, we should get to talk to you, but why should he get to have anything to do with you? He's not even 8. But these were some of his questions for you. What makes you feel very peaceful?
Oh, these are proper questions. I thought you were going to say, how does a sonic screwdriver work?
What makes me
feel very peaceful? I mean, that'd be life without a deadline. I don't have those, really. Oh. And then when I don't have a deadline, then I'd be anxious.
I was going to say, I bet you can't handle life without
no
a
peace.
Deadline. You have no peace.
Your
That's okay.
Going straight to the nub.
What was it like only having 2 or 3 channels on TV when you were a kid?
Well, we were happy. We couldn't imagine a different world.
You've got this quite traditional thing in that you're still watching the soaps. And
I'm still watching terrestrial,
Linear TV is a
big
part
of your life.
I do feel
like my friend Phil Connerson, who produces Doctor Who with me, my friend, his mum just died, passed away, and I now feel there's just one of us watching Coronation Street. Because it was me and her. That was it. I am the last terrestrial viewer.
And yet, from watching your work, you seem very plugged into the contemporary culture as well.
Do you know what? I think that's a gay thing, because it's that way forever being debated. Someone's always trying to get a law to cancel us. Some 2 men will kiss, and that still makes headlines. I mean, you sit there going, for Christ's sake, is that still making headlines? Then all trans war stuff as well. So I think actually simply by being out and gay, you get dragged into what modern culture is, whether you like it or not. I'm glad that I am, because it's always fascinating. Come on, more questions. These are good.
Thank you. I'll tell him you said so. What doctor did you love the most when you were my age?
So actually, that was John Pertwee. But as a younger classic viewer, it's Tom Baker. I mean, it's the most extraordinary piece, still to this day, most extraordinary piece of casting in the most extraordinary role that's probably ever happened.
Just can you be normal around him?
Oh, I've never met him. I've never met Tom Baker. No.
That feels like a choice. Then,
I said,
right?
No, he's very old now. He doesn't leave his house.
But you've been doing this for a long time.
That's true. But he wasn't around. It's like even he's so old that even 15 years ago when I was on the show, he was still old.
Yeah.
I mean, he came and did that 50th. That's when Stephen Moffat was in charge. So, but I don't do conventions and things.
You want to motion capture him and then you could CGI some stuff in the future.
I can imagine.
It's like you're Charlie in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and you inherited the Chocolate Factory.
I built the Chocolate
you
Factory.
You built the Chocolate Factory. So what does that do to your ability to enjoy the chocolate?
Oh, love it. I was so made for television. When I was 7 and used to watch Doctor Who or plays and things like that, I knew when things were on film and I knew that when they were on videotape in a studio, I knew. When I was young, I'd sit there and my mum like going, that's outside, that's indoors. I kind of knew if a sitcom was pre-recorded or if that was live. I think that's partly being a Doctor Who fan. The very first books you could have read was The Making of Doctor Who. But even before that, I knew. I'm a television child. I just am.
God, thank God you were talented, because how depressing if you hadn't have been able to go and do this
but
for yourself.
But I think then, if I hadn't been, I'd be writing lists. You'd find a different way to love it.
You'd do a podcast.
Yeah.
So I had a very similar relationship with television as a kid.
I'd love to do a podcast.
I've got just a couple more things, if I may. This is from my son, and this is his last question for you. What is your favorite animal?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose it's the elephant, just because that's so mad. And if you were a child and you had to invent an animal, you'd invent the elephant. I'm not an animal person.
Okay.
No cats and no dogs. And I think you're mad if you have a cat or a dog. I think it's like you have an idiot in the house.
Okay, tell us more.
Imagine having a dog. Are you nuts?
You like your own company. You're this independent person. I'm very needy. I want something to be happy to see me.
The dog's needy. It needs its food. It needs warmth. It's like a prisoner. Mm-hmm. It's a hostage. Even let it run free.
The reason I showed you that photo before is I loved Doctor Who as a kid and I love it again as an adult. It never made me cry as a child, and it almost always makes me cry now, or very frequently does.
Yes. Do you know, I tell you why?
Yeah.
I tell you why. It used to be a four-camera studio show. Now it's a single-camera drama. That's in your face. It used to be proscenium arch. It's like it's very hard for that stuff to make you cry, to get into the emotion. It wasn't about that. It was about monsters coming through doorways, moving right and left. I will stop you. People on stage, basically. And now you've got a great big well-lit close-up. If it's not making you cry or making love, what's it doing? You know, you're just saying the plot. It's a single camera. It's well lit. It's shot like drama now. And they worked very hard in the old days. I'm not criticizing them for that. But that day has gone for drama. And that's it. That's where it comes from. It's not us sitting there going, we must make you cry. It's like, but once the camera's that close to you, what are you going to do?
Feel something.
Exactly. And I think has made it a better show, to be absolutely honest.
Will you be giving us anywhere to take him? Because when I was a kid, there was that thing in Blackpool we could go to. And then in the years where I didn't have a small child, there was that Doctor Who Experience, I think.
That was me. I wish. I mean, that Doctor Who Experience lost a lot of money. And that's not a secret. It just did. I loved it. It was brilliant. It wasn't when I was on the show. It was so lavish. No wonder it lost money. So it's kind of once bitten, twice shy. It's like,
so it's not on your list.
We're going to see how successful it becomes. It's like, that's the other thing. It's like, if it starts to get the kids watching, if it starts to sell the toys, if it starts to create a demand, then it'll start to happen.
Why don't you put out a Meep plush toy and see how it does?
Hold your breath.
Is that happening?
Uh-huh. Hold on. Yeah. What am I looking for? Come on.
Russell's showing us a
prototype Meep.
Oh, wow. Do you get to keep that?
It's gorgeous, isn't it? That's actually got my name.
I had never watched an episode of Doctor Who before I married my husband. I'm sorry. But it's a sin. Gosh. Queer as folk. I'm there. But I've gotten into it because our kid loves it and Jeff loves it. How much do you care about converting someone like me versus keeping someone like Jeff happy?
Oh, interesting. That is a constant balance all the time. I just think Jeff's going to make it good. That's all. Yeah, if it's good, people will come and watch. And we're quite careful. I mean, for a 61-year-old program, its continuity is remarkably intact. It's messy here and there, but that's fine. That's actually creative to have a messy continuity. But I love a little mention of an old something from the 1960s. I love doing that because I know that an awful lot of people will sit at home and clap. But equally, I want you to sit there and cry. And you won't do that with a mention from something from the 1960s. It's not that you want new viewers. It's that I can't believe some people don't watch Doctor Who. I find that astonishing. And they're missing out on so much.
Oh, but people love to tell you that they don't watch it. Do you know what I mean? If you say Doctor Who, people don't like it. No. In a way, that doesn't happen with other shows.
I did that Nolly show, the one about Noel Gordon.
Yes, I love that.
And someone turns around and says, I only watch television for the news of the wildlife.
Yes.
She goes, oh, fuck off.
Yeah.
I specifically put that in. But people like that.
Yeah.
It's like, don't talk rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, who else would say that? You wouldn't say it about novels. You wouldn't say it about art. I would say it about opera. I can't buy opera. But I mean, have you been to the opera?
It's not for me.
I went to my husband to an opera and I left at the interval. And afterwards he said to me, you didn't just leave. You actually ran away. I saw you running across the bay while I went back in for the second half. Oh, I couldn't bear it.
How did your marriage recover?
Oh, easily. It wasn't opera dependent.
Okay.
Did he work in television as well?
No, he was a civil servant. He worked in customs. I remember when I met him in our very first, April the 12th, 1998, and our very first conversation in the nightclub was there. I said, I'm a writer. And he went, you write? He literally had no concept of there being people who wrote dialogue for things on screen.
I have to admit, I don't know where you were at professionally at 1998. Yes. Were you
Queer
very established by then?
It was a funny thing. And when I met him, then I was writing Queer as Folk, so I was delighted he was there before life kind of went mad and has never stopped. So he was there just at the right time, just before. I was really pleased.
What would you guys talk about?
He loved quizzes. He loved television. He loved Coronation Street. He was also a terrestrial viewer. He loved all that. Yeah. We just had a nice time. We were very quiet. We didn't even holiday much or do anything much, really. We just had a very nice time together. It was lovely.
It was my favourite thing.
Lovely, yeah.
Before we let you go, what are you watching at the moment?
Oh, I'm kind of into that Mary and George. They got sexy and lovely, and he's beautiful, and it's Julianne Moore. I like Waterloo Road. I think that's great. I think it's young. I think hearts are burning. Children cry and rage and scream, and teenagers tear their hearts out. I love all the modern Star Treks. It's just so much TV, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the point of the podcast?
What a thing to get to spend time in the company of Russell T. Davis.
So special.
And we want to thank a friend. Friend of the pod. It's one of these things where it's somebody we got to know through the pod. We've only met them once, but it just feels like it's a friendship that is inevitable and it's going to happen. We just haven't.
I think we're going to call her our friend, Jan McBerry. Jan, this happened 100% because you went to bat for us and we are so grateful. And it was such a special moment on the overall journey of this pod. So thank you, thank you, thank you for making dreams come true.
We'll send you a fruit basket.
Jeff, well, I'm not thoughtful in that way.
All right, to the email.
To the inbox. Take it to the inbox. To the inbox. Take it to the inbox.
Inbox.
No, it's not good when you do it.
Okay.
This first email comes from Sarah, who writes, "Dear Mom and Dad, I was listening to your previous show when you mentioned your son gets upset if he hears swearing." He really does. "I found that funny, as you're the biggest Succession fans. Does he know? If you said to our son, hi, what TV show are your parents into? He would go, Succession. And if you said to him, who wrote Succession? He would go, Jesse Armstrong. But I don't think he has any sense of what it's about or that it's very, very salty language. Unknown to my parents," Sarah continues, "as a 12-year-old, me and my bestie would watch The Sopranos because it was broadcast straight after Friends every week. Eventually, we counted how many times they said fuck in an episode. It was over 120.
That's so funny. But my mum really didn't like bad language.
No.
And she would tut and harumph if it was ever on TV. But she loved The Sopranos and she'd go, I don't like it, our Jeffrey, but it's just how they spoke, isn't it? It's just how they spoke in the Mafia.
Recommendations of something funny. It's from 2004, but if you haven't seen it, Green Wing.
Oh, Green Wing.
Never heard of this.
Do you know, I never consistently watched it, but when I saw it, I would enjoy it. I wonder how that has aged. That's interesting.
She says, to me, it's up there with Arrested Development, Peep Show, and a bit of Fry and Laurie.
Uh-huh.
It's about an emergency hospital ward where the staff are all clinically insane with Tamsin Grieg, Stephen Mangan, oh, and also Olivia Colman. I've been thinking about Olivia Colman because a favorite moment that I have in Girls 5 Eva is where she's mentioned and just as a thrown away line, someone goes, equally comfortable in comedy and drama. And that is how quick they say it. And it's very funny to me. P.S. Would love to hear what is in your personal hall of fame for TV and movies and an interview with Mike White. I would love to speak to Mike White. Can you imagine? How do we get him? Who knows him? Who can be the Jan McBerry to Russell T. Davies? So if any of you know him, you let old Firecrotch you know, and I will get on the case. Thank you for the podcast, Sarah. Do you want to get at any of your personal Hall of Fame for TV and movies?
I think something that's dropped out of the culture a little bit that is in my top three, certainly, is The Larry Sanders Show. I think it is one of the best drawn character comedies of all time.
Okay, so for me, for TV, I would say Sopranos, like ultimate tip-top of the tip-top, Sopranos and 30 Rock. And then for films, you've got to watch Girls Trip. I will keep banging the drum for Girls Trip. And then in a more serious way, have you watched Mulholland Drive? It's one of my favorite films of all time.
The next email comes from retired podcaster and current actor, Craig Parkinson.
What's going on for Craig and when is he going to come on the pod, do you think?
I don't know. I really would love to talk to Craig on this.
Craig, come to us. Just tell us when is right.
Dear Jeff and Sarah, I wanted to recommend you a TV documentary. It's available on iPlayer. It's called Three Salons at the Seaside. This is a fantastic documentary. I've got it on VHS.
Oh.
He says it focuses on three different hair salons in the 80s around Blackpool and the people that work there and the folk that come to get their hair done. I'm sure that sounds incredibly dull, but it's anything but. One of the salons was where my grandma had her hair done all her life. She could have been a reality star. Mm. He says, Jeff, you may see some early Caroline Ahern stroke Mrs. Merton inspiration too. Well, I know for a fact Craig and Caroline were obsessed with this documentary. And the VHS copy that I've got, Caroline's brother sent to me.
Interesting. Yeah. Maybe you should do a rewatch and see what you think now.
Yeah, I have to find. Oh, it's on iPlayer. I was thinking, have we still got a VHS player?
In the attic, you bought one at one point, I think.
Yeah. It says, hope you're both well. We are. I had a UTI, but the antibiotics have really kicked in, and now I've got the urinary tract of a newborn.
Oh, God. I don't want to talk about it anymore. This next one comes from Keith Trotter. We don't usually have so many men. This is only 2 out of 3, but it's nice to see. I like when gentlemen contribute.
Yeah.
Women are more participators. I don't know if you heard.
What do women be like and men be like?
Women be like, I'm participating. Men be like, I'm not participating. Hey, FCNMC, longtime listener and second time emailer. Had to respond to Normcore's dislike of Vinnie Jones. I try not to say I hate people I don't actually know in real life, but he may be the celeb exception. As well as for the reasons Jeff gave, nasty footballer celebrated by nasty fans for being nasty on and off the pitch. I think he was one of the first of that particular type of celeb with connections to film and TV pals who then somehow uses those connections to get acting roles for no discernible reason. And then inexplicably, he keeps getting them. He's some kind of weird sideways Nepo man, baby. And now, just because I don't want to be singularly negative, a few TV recommends. Good News, another Tina Fey comedy. So unabashedly funny and just hitting its stride when it was canceled.
We never saw that, did we? Was it Ted Danson?
I don't know. What I can say is that, like, the Tina Fey stuff, because I'm so obsessed with 30 Rock, there was a while there where other stuff she would do, I would just show up for. And it was never quite given me quite the hit I needed, with the exception of Sisters. And now, Girls 5 Ava. But maybe I'll give it a go. Next, Babylon Berlin. That was first recommended to us in the first iteration of this pod by Scroobius Pip.
Yeah, didn't you watch quite a lot of episodes of it and really liked it?
4 Blocks.
Oh, okay.
Set in Berlin, but you're confusing. But anyway, I know. Babylon Berlin, I know. Keith describes it as Secret Army does cabaret. Oh. Just astounding TV in interwar Germany with some great shock deaths and great, actually not deaths. Okay, I maybe have to do this. Yellow Jackets, cannibalistic 90s fringe cheerleaders is both a disappointingly reductive descriptor, but it is also bang on. Promise I'll join the Patreon after payday, but only to keep Sarah in petties, not to buy you a dog. That's fair.
The email address is?
fuckoff@firecrotchandnormcore.com.
All right, so this week, Russell T. Davis likes to watch all the modern Star Treks, especially Star Trek Discovery on Paramount Plus, Waterloo Road on BBC iPlayer, and Mary and George on Sky and Now TV. Sarah liked to watch The Push, Murder on the Cliff, on Channel 4. I watched Derek Del Guardio in and of itself on Disney Plus. And we watch Palm Royale on Apple TV Plus.
Well, we're going in. We're going in to the Easter holidays. I'm not excited about it. I know I'm supposed to be, but I'm not.
I'll get you a nice egg. Get you a nice dark chocolate egg. You like dark chocolate?
It's not a thing for me. It's not a big thing in the States. You always think it's going to be nice and springy, and then it's invariably, like, really, really cold, and I have to, like, be laid back about Jean eating a huge amount of sugar, but it, like, makes me, I don't like it. I get uncomfortable with too much sugar. I don't know. It just doesn't do anything for me. You know, Thanksgiving does something for me. Halloween does something for me. Christmas does something for me. But Easter holidays is like, what is this? I don't support it. We're going into it. It's a shitty time in the calendar year. Can we just all just stay in school and, like, get this tacked on to the summer holidays instead? I vote for that. To all the parents out there, have a great time with your family. We'll be having a great time together. And see you next week when we've all been together the whole week with our families. Bye!
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.